This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Plague, One Scientist's Intrepid Search for the Truth About Human Retroviruses and Chronic Fatigue Syndrome, MECFS, Autism, and Other Diseases. Written by Kent Heckenlively, J.D., and Judy A. Mikovits, Ph.D. Narrated by Eric Martin. Narrated by Eric Martin. An inefficient virus kills its host. A clever virus stays with it. James Lovelock. You do not become a dissident just because you decide one day to take up this most unusual career. You are thrown into it by your personal sense of responsibility, combined with a complex set of external circumstances. You are cast out of the existing structures and placed in a position of conflict with them. It begins as an attempt to do your work well and ends with being branded an enemy of society. Václav Havel. Foreword. A Disease Able to Affect the Economies of Nations by Hillary Johnson. Hers was the last presentation of the day, and the moderator allowed a final question. I raised my hand. Is it true that you have discovered a novel pathogen in this disease? I had heard a rumor, but my expectations couldn't have been lower. Silence ensued while Judy Mikovits gripped the sides of the podium as if weighing her options. Yes, she finally said. There was scattered laughter in the hall, as if she had just made a joke. Only an audience of people who have been ill for a very long time and who have even the slightest knowledge of the fraught history of their disease could be so devoid of hope that such a claim could be considered laughable. It's not a new pathogen, Mikovits pressed on, suddenly lowering her voice to a degree barely audible. But it is new to this disease. We have submitted a paper to science, she added. On that intriguing scientific riddle, the annual scientific conference held by the UK charity Invest in ME at One Birdcage Walk near London's Houses of Parliament ended. It was May of 2009. My friendship and professional relationship with Judy Mikovits began. She could not have imagined the inferno she was about to enter, the ups and downs and startling turns of which are described in this book. I would watch and listen in sympathy over the next 3 years as Mikovits, challenged and derided by critics in a way few scientists will ever experience, seemed to leap from one circle of hell to another. Ultimately, her crime would emerge as heresy, a sub rosa charge reserved for anyone who dared offer evidence for a viral cause, and worse, transmissibility, in a disease governments on every continent had for 3 decades effectively disappeared, with a contradictory melange of explanations, none of them logical. With her pending publication still undergoing editing, Mikovits was about to lead a battle charge in what has often been described as medicine's holy war. But then, the 11-syllable myalgic encephalomyelitis, understandably shorthanded to ME, has never been regarded as an ordinary disease, nor has the public health response to it been anywhere near normal. Instead, it's been saddled with an extraordinary burden of meaning, a word Susan Sontag employed in her famous essay, Illness as Metaphor. Nothing is more punitive than to give a disease meaning, that meaning invariably being a moralistic one, Sontag wrote. Any important disease whose causality is murky and for which treatment is ineffectual tends to be awash in significance. Since its emergence in the late 1970s in pandemic form, ME has been touted as a psychiatric affliction of people with poor coping strategies or histories of unachievable ambition, as one American government scientist wrote in an influential paper in 1988. Ultimately, any hypothesis regarding the cause of ME must incorporate the psychopathology that accompanies it, and in some cases precedes it, he added. Aided by a passive lay press, government scientists have sought to dismiss the disease by labeling sufferers with all manner of deficiencies and malevolent motives. That list has included malingering and cheating welfare systems, being either sympathy seekers or type A personalities who one day simply fell apart, or people who read about the disease and wanted to have it. The Centers for Disease Control, CDC, probably wins any contest as to which U.S. government entity has done more to trash victims and belittle the disease. CDC has trotted out hysteria, yuppie burnout, a genetically linked inability to handle stress, a history of childhood sexual molestation, doctors working themselves into a frenzy, collusion between patients and doctors, and an epidemic of diagnoses, to name a few of the untenable causes handed down from on high over the past 30 years. Any collective memory of just how suddenly and aggressively this disease emerged in the late 1970s and early 1980s, especially in large coastal cities like New York, Boston, Los Angeles, and San Francisco, recedes with each passing year. Anyone born after, say, 1985 or 1990 will be unable to recall a period in their own lives when this scourge was virtually unknown. Yet, by the mid-1980s, distressed doctors and desperate patients had turned the disease into the top category of inquiry at both the Centers for Disease Control and public health departments in the major cities of this country. Eventually, their calls both to the CDC and NIH exceeded queries about AIDS at the height of the AIDS epidemic. In 1988, a small group of worried scientists and research clinicians met to discuss the disease and its origins in Newport, Rhode Island. Charles Carpenter, professor of medicine at Brown University Hospital, noted, "We're seeing something that wasn't there in the 50s and 60s. Most of us feel this is new. If this had been going on in the 50s and 60s, even if we had discarded it as psychiatric, it would have been written about, and it's not in the literature." And that suggests there is a dominant agent that's driving the disease. Another doctor, Paul Cheney, agreed. "How could we have possibly missed this disease for all these years?" he asked. Although a large number of patients are subtle and may not be that sick, there are a significant number of patients who are really quite incredible, and I just can't believe the medical profession could have watched this, missed this, for decades or millennia. It's too striking. 26 years after Carpenter and Cheney voiced their concerns, current estimates place the number of sufferers worldwide at 20 million, with a million or more of them in the U.S., exceeding the number of patients with breast and lung cancer, AIDS, and multiple sclerosis combined. Today, a doctor in New York City Skypes with patients in Uzbekistan, Scotland, and Norway. Japanese, Chinese, and Latvian investigators attend medical conferences in San Francisco. ME is now the most common chronic disease most people have never heard of until they acquire it. By 2009, when Mikovits appeared on the scene, ME was a disease with a shocking history of neglect that rose to the level of government-sanctioned human rights violations perpetrated upon millions around the world. Patients were denied not merely medical care, payouts on disability claims, and the emotional support that might have been forthcoming from family and friends had they suffered from a real disease. They had been thoroughly disenfranchised and subjected to ridicule and abuse from all quarters. If they were children, they were denied educations. Adults and children were on occasion incarcerated in psychiatric institutions against their wills, a ghastly outcome resulting, in at least some well-documented cases, their deaths. The spiral into years and decades of poverty that frequently accompanied onset of the disease was perhaps the most intolerable outcome of all. ME was a storm gathering on the horizon in the late 1970s, a rumored malady that sounded too incredible to believe. Like mono, except you never recover, was how the disease was first described to me by a fellow journalist who had his ear to the ground. This once rare disease was about to explode in tandem with the AIDS epidemic, but those with ME would share a very different fate. Rather than spend billions of dollars on research and reorder the medical research cosmos on its behalf, public health authorities would seek to disappear ME by any means available, whether by marginalizing its victims or, as documented in my book Osler's Web, conspiring to prevent congressionally mandated research on it. There is a magnificent treatise waiting to be penned about the divergent paths taken by governments of great nations as regards AIDS and ME, so thinly separated as to symptoms and aberrant biological signs. Both diseases have as hallmarks a deranged immune system that allows myriad viral infections to propagate, viruses that normally would remain latent, an elevated cancer risk, dementia, and more. As long ago as 1986, a top neurologist was unable to differentiate the two diseases while studying MRI brain scans of ME patients pocked with multiple small lesions and reduced gray matter, and those of patients with AIDS-related dementia, or ARD. Patients suffer from a devastating cascade of symptoms, rendering them ghosts of the people they once were. More than half become completely disabled, a quarter permanently bedbound. Recovery is rare. Morbidity studies have demonstrated that ME patients are as ill as end-stage AIDS sufferers, advanced cancer patients, and people dying from congestive heart failure. With her publication in Science the following October, Mikovits would provide highly persuasive evidence for an AIDS-like viral infection existing in close to 70% of patients and 4% of healthy controls. The virus was called XMRV and had been discovered at the University of California in 2006. A member of the gamma retrovirus family, XMRV was classified as a murine leukemia virus, one which likely had jumped from its natural reservoir, mice, to humans at some juncture in the recent past. Although XMRV's discovery had aroused little fanfare, Mikovits's data drawing an association between the virus and ME, rare immune cancers, and eventually autism, raised a firestorm 3 years later. If her data were right, then 10 million people in America alone were infected, but asymptomatic, with this virus. At one juncture during the ensuing scientific fracas, an incredulous vice president of the American Red Cross, Roger Dodd, dubbed Mikovits's findings the doomsday scenario. In other words, it was too horrible to be true. A media-stoked controversy erupted as laboratories around the world sought to replicate the findings in ME patients, a drama that played out over the next 3 years with a kind of fury rarely seen in science. Famous scientists shouted over each other's presentations during normally staid conferences. Relationships shattered and paranoia blossomed, revealing scientists to be not atypical of the rest of humanity. Publications as diverse as The Economist and Science News followed the story faithfully and with bemused interest, as if the often down-and-dirty dash to confirm or deny was a tennis match, instead of a pressing scientific matter, the outcome of which had the potential to affect the economies of nations. One highly conservative estimate of the annual loss to the U.S. economy from ME was $20 billion, a figure based on the unreasonable assumption that everyone disabled by the disease had been earning just $20,000 a year when they fell ill. Given the history of the long-politicized disease at the center of the controversy, the uproar was hardly surprising. Yet, the baseball hat and flip-flop-wearing scientist at the center of the controversy, who bragged of her shared ancestry with Attila the Hun, was a surprise. She was 46, with oftentimes unkempt, sun-streaked hair and wide, innocent-looking blue eyes. She looked like she would be happiest at the helm of a sailboat in some far reaches of the Pacific Ocean. In reality, she was a molecular biologist and biochemist, and the author of approximately 50 publications on the immunology of HIV, its cancers, and the chemistry of drugs to fight its infections. A 22-year veteran of the National Cancer Institute, she had been mentored in her early years by Frank Rossetti in his lab at Fort Detrick, Maryland. Rossetti was himself a veteran of Robert Gallo's brutally competitive AIDS lab. Perhaps understandably, sufferers of this disease felt that with the materialization of Mikovits and her collaborators, especially Rossetti, co-discoverer of the first human retrovirus in 1980, the grown-ups had arrived. Certainly, Mikovits was not and would never be among the beleaguered ME clinicians and researchers of past decades, a stalwart if tiny fraternity in perpetual need of funds, well known to each other and to patients. Since the early 1980s, the latter had existed as if in some kind of dystopian parallel universe, in possession of information they deemed urgent, but in which few besides themselves were interested. A constant at their scientific conferences were the ashen-faced patients, mostly women, lying in fetal positions on the carpeted corridors outside the hotel ballrooms, blankets pulled up to their necks. Somehow they had made their way there, but the effort cost them everything. Certainly, there was little doubt that Mikovits was a different kind of scientist, one who didn't seek the approval of the top guns at the NIH, and who wasn't afraid to upbraid scientists at the CDC, whether via email or in person. Indeed, she had a quality of fierceness rarely seen in science. She would call XMRV the biggest epidemic in United States history, one destined to turn the U.S. into the equivalent of HIV-riddled sub-Sahara Africa if it continued unabated. She labeled the Centers for Disease Control criminal for what she saw as the agency's failure to control the spread of XMRV. Inside her lab, the Atlanta agency's acronym stood for Can't, Don't Care. She and her staff derided the agency's method of selecting patients by random telephone surveys, calling the government's cohort Publishers Clearinghouse patients. Judy Mikovits was unshakable in her convictions and harsh on her critics whom she considered biased, occasionally dishonest, and often ill-informed. She was a charming advocate of patients. Startlingly for a scientist, she even consorted with them, seeking them out and befriending them, once posting her personal email address prominently to the blogosphere. Her rationale was not just humane, but utterly reasonable. Her understanding of this disease arose from patients and their histories, and she formulated hypotheses for scientific experiments based on what she heard and observed. The ancient Greeks would have lauded Mikovits for her methods, but in the 21st century, she was an oddball. As far as other scientists were concerned, perhaps her greatest sin was her public conjecture about what her data might imply for other unsolved diseases, especially autism, a malady that vied with ME as a biopolitical hot button. She had identified family clusters in which parents and other close adult relatives suffered from ME and children suffered from autism, and found evidence for gamma retrovirus infection in victims of both diseases. It was one thing to pose scientific hypotheses about controversial disorders over drinks at the conference hotel bar with lab colleagues, but to explain in some detail such hypotheses on daytime television talk shows or to journalists from major American newspapers, as Mikovits did, was another matter. Federal scientists, who frequently confuse their mandate to perform research with a mandate to prevent public panic, were especially unnerved by the use of words like infection and transmission in the same sentence with words like autism or lymphoma, and certainly in conjunction with what the CDC calls, in preference to ME, chronic fatigue syndrome. Of course, it's a rare and delicate venture in science to be first, and few hazard the risk. Mikovits's primary science collaborator and unabashed admirer, Rossetti, said of Mikovits, "What I always tried to teach her is, learn the scientific method and learn it well so that you can publish something that 99% of the scientific community might say, you are wrong, but which you know is right." That is the courage of a true scientist, and Judy has that. Perhaps it's unsurprising that for the next 3 years, Mikovits stood unbowed at the center of a crackling scientific storm that raged over several continents. If she was correct, and a highly infectious retrovirus was in fact the cause of chronic fatigue syndrome, and 10 million Americans were already infected, well, that not only changed the geometry, but shattered the credibility of the nation's bulwark against infectious disease, the CDC, and its more prestigious sister agency, the National Institutes of Health. By year 3, pondering the 5-foot-5-inch Mikovits and her place in the scientific cosmos brought to mind Abraham Lincoln's purported remark to Harriet Beecher Stowe, "So you're the little woman who wrote the book that started this great war." Mikovits had been so insulated in what could be called the HIV/AIDS research bubble, she had never heard of ME until being enlisted as scientific director of a new institute affiliated with the University of Nevada in Reno. What drew her to such a foolhardy fate? A rush of intuition, facts lining up with facts, her knowledge of AIDS immunology, a eureka moment. "I spent my whole life working on this. I just didn't know it," she would say later. In 2006, she sat in the audience at a conference in Barcelona and listened to a veteran of the ME wars, a doctor who had seen thousands of patients and had learned about the disease in real time right along with them, talk about a group of 300 patients he had followed for years. Dan Peterson of Nevada, an internal medicine specialist with a wait list measured in years, described what Mikovits would call opportunistic infections in these patients, multiple immune deficiencies, a kind of subacute encephalopathy that lowered IQ and destroyed even the brightest patient's ability to think straight, complemented by abnormal brain scans using several technologies. The doctor offered data for cytokine storms, an onslaught of inflammatory proteins like interferon that leveled victims, generated in response to infections. He noted that 5% of patients in this carefully observed group had rare immune system cancers that would be expected to occur in the general population at rates closer to 0.02%. In all, 77 of the 300 had either blood cancers or cellular changes that were predictive of lymphoma. Mikovits was struck to her core. "It's a retrovirus," she thought, almost saying the words out loud. HIV was one of three retrovirus families known to infect humans. Maybe there were four, Mikovits wondered. Long known to infect domestic animals such as cats and cattle, as well as wild animals, retroviruses caused cancer, immune deficiency, and horrendous neurodegenerative diseases. If the disease Peterson described wasn't AIDS, it was akin to AIDS, or as Mikovits would say eventually, the other AIDS, or non-HIV AIDS. She leapt to the microphone when Peterson finished. "I'm a cancer researcher," she said. "Number one, I look for viruses in cancer, and number two, this smells like a virus." 3 years later, having met hundreds of sufferers on both sides of the Atlantic, she would comment, "It's amazing to me that anyone could look at these patients and not see that this is an infectious disease that ruins lives." There is an immense backstory to Mikovits's contemporary story, a heart-rending tale of dashed scientific careers and broken-hearted people who have made important-seeming discoveries about ME and ended up on the sidelines, incredulous that their work went unheralded and, more importantly, unfunded. Not infrequently, those discoveries were evidence for retroviral infection. Experts familiar with the clinical manifestations of the disease have recognized retroviruses as a class of pathogens with the power to cause all the symptoms and outcomes they document: immune deficiency, neurodegenerative disease, and greatly elevated rates of cancer. One reads again and again that the cause of the disease is elusive and the disease itself mysterious. Implicit in these clichés is that some organized, concerted effort has been undertaken to solve the mystery to no avail. Contrary to popular belief, however, searches for a causative infectious agent in the disease have been rare, limited in scope, and for the most part either poorly funded or virtually unfunded. As long ago as the early 1980s, Campbell Murdoch, a local doctor in Dunedin, New Zealand, began referring patients to University of Otago microbiologist and medical doctor Michael Holmes, a dark-haired, enthusiastic, and open-minded young scientist whose appearance and temperament were compared by his colleagues to Henry VIII. Interestingly, the disease was known popularly in Dunedin as poor man's AIDS. The South Island of New Zealand was hit by the malady by the late 1970s, perhaps most famously in the small town of Tapa Nui, a village less than 2 hours inland from coastal Dunedin. Locals there adopted the mellifluous name Tapa Nui Flu. Holmes, whose primary interest was clinical immunovirology, spent several years prior to his retirement in 2002 studying poor man's AIDS for evidence of retroviruses. In 1986, using the equivalent of $690 given to him by patients, Holmes looked at six sufferers and six healthy controls and discovered reverse transcriptase, an enzyme used by retroviruses in their replication process, in four of six patients. In addition, he found cells with convoluted nuclei comparable to those described in the ARC, AIDS-related complex syndrome. These were not present in controls. We would like to propose a retrovirus etiology for CFS based not only on this pilot study, but on the train of deductive observation which led us to consider it in the first place, Holmes wrote. Part of that deductive observation had been the cytokine interferon seen in extremely high levels in ME patients. The most powerful interferon inducers are retroviruses, Holmes added. 2 years later, Holmes was awarded $7,000 from patients to continue the hunt, this time with 20 patients. Again, he saw the convoluted nuclei also seen in HIV disease. 4 years later, he had scrounged enough money to investigate another 20 patients with similar results. By then, 1991, American immunologist Elaine DeFreitas had published her own discovery of retroviral gene sequences in 80% of adult and child ME sufferers and in 4% of controls. Unfortunately, DeFreitas had been, in Holmes's memorable words, savaged and thrown to the wolves. As a direct result, in his opinion, Holmes's interesting research reached a dead end with the scientific establishment in New Zealand and the rest of the world. After Holmes presented his findings at an ME conference in 1994 in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, the only study on causality out of 60 presentations, a CDC epidemiologist, Keiji Fukuda, who today is the Assistant Director General for Health, Security, and Environment at the World Health Organization, told me matter-of-factly, "To talk about etiologies is to raise false hopes. It will not be Agent X causing disease Y." Fukuda's comments were representative of the denialist mindset the peppery, often sardonic DeFreitas encountered at the CDC, when, after her discovery was reported in Newsweek and several major newspapers, scientists in Atlanta approached her. DeFreitas, who was a fast-rising star at the Wistar Institute in Philadelphia and had been mentored by its world-famous director, Hilary Koprowski, commanded about as much respect from the male retrovirologists at CDC as did the patients whose blood she was studying. In defiance of protocol, they refused to follow her methods at every turn. Ignoring her prescription against freezing blood, scientists froze ME blood samples in order to take vacations. They employed chemical reagents DeFreitas had warned against. They cast aside reagents she recommended. They regarded the ratios of particular nutrients DeFreitas used to nurture her cell cultures and the virus as unimportant. "There's always enough time to do it wrong, but never enough time to do it right," DeFreitas noted at the time. She also said, presciently, "If a plague were to hit this country, the CDC would be the last to know." Eventually, DeFreitas urged the agency to send a scientist to her lab in Philadelphia to work side by side with her. She would bring the horses to water and hope they'd drink. Wistar director Koprowski offered the Institute's luxurious corporate apartment to CDC scientists as lodgings. Citing a lack of money to pay the round-trip airfare of a scientist from Atlanta, CDC administrators refused both invitations. That's how much the U.S. government either didn't care or didn't want to know what DeFreitas had found in victims of this rapidly spreading disease. "The CDC is culpable," Mikovits told me during one conversation about DeFreitas's discovery. "They let an entire generation become infected. I think they all know there's a huge class action lawsuit here." By the time CDC officials published their failure to confirm DeFreitas's finding in not just one but four publications, and had written a letter to her boss suggesting she be fired, academic scientists were comparing DeFreitas to Joan of Arc. She had dared propose an infectious etiology for ME. She had dared to turn it into a real disease. I always thought a comparison with the mythological Cassandra more apt. DeFreitas's then-75-year-old boss, Kaprowski, was a Polish émigré of the 1930s and considered by many to be personally responsible for the European brain drain of the 1950s, during which scientists left Europe in droves for America. Many of them found a home at the Wistar Institute. Kaprowski, who took a great interest in ME and characterized it as an infectious disease of the brain, told me he believed the NIH needed an institute akin in size and scope to the National Cancer Institute to fight ME and other burgeoning central nervous system diseases. Kaprowski believed all of them would turn out to have an infectious cause, much like polio and rabies. With DeFreitas's tantalizing findings demolished by the CDC, research into the cause of ME rapidly slid into a scientific equivalent of the Mojave Desert, where the disease lay like a corpse for 20 years to be picked over by a scavenging psychiatric lobby, as patients call the still-influential psychiatrists. The latter have turned ME into a winking euphemism they call bodily distress syndrome, characterized by medically unexplained symptoms, aka MUPS. They have managed to persuade much of the medical establishment that cognitive behavioral therapy is an effective treatment. Certainly, talk therapy is less expensive to administer than a full-out research effort into the cause. Federal dollars to search for pathogenic etiologies would never be forthcoming. Nihilism settled over those rare iconoclastic clinician investigators and even rarer scientists who continued to find the malady alarming. They returned to publishing papers about symptoms, things like the pompously titled post-exertional malaise, the inevitable crash that occurs in patients who exert themselves, or impaired blood flow to the brain, or pathologically low blood pressure. There are today some 5,000-plus papers on abnormalities in ME that have appeared in scientific journals since the dawn of the 1980s, yet government officials continue to tell reporters there are no biomarkers. With Swiftian logic, the same officials tell each other that the disease needs to be broken into myriad subsets because, they insist, it's simply unimaginable that everyone could have the same thing. A new way of saying, as did the CDC's Keiji Fukuda 20 years ago, it will not be a case of Agent X causing disease Y. After meeting Judy Mikovits in London in the spring of 2009, I wondered, had the day of reckoning arrived? Would Mikovits be the scientist who would resolve this disease, or would she go down in flames? Without meaning to be cryptic, I believe the answer is a bit of yes on both counts. We have CDC-proofed this paper, Mikovits assured me in September of 2009, shortly before her study was published in Science. She might have been new to the disease, but she was well acquainted with its political history. Earlier in July, her work had held up beautifully when two AIDS experts at the National Cancer Institute called a secret meeting of top gamma retrovirus experts to deliberate on the matter. The government's primary concerns: how to manage an unpredictable public once the news of XMRV and its possible relationship to cancer was publicized, and what to do about all those infected, asymptomatic people. That's the piece of the data that scared everybody, Mikovits remembered. They didn't care about chronic fatigue syndrome. 10 million people infected with a retrovirus of unknown pathogenic potential. In this country, by comparison, 800,000 people are infected with HIV. In the tumult that followed, concern turned to scorn when several laboratories were unable to confirm the work, and in time, a persuasive argument was presented by an American scientist, initially a staunch Mikovits supporter, that XMRV was a man-made virus, a contaminant, that had been spreading from laboratory to laboratory since the mid-1990s. Mikovits and her collaborators accepted the verdict on XMRV, but drowned out in the resulting furor and even ridicule was Mikovits's voice. She insisted that evidence for gamma retrovirus infection in ME remained strong and was deserving of continued study. As with HIV, she argued, likely there were multiple strains of the pathogen, and she noted that her research supported that hypothesis. She also referenced another scientist, a reclusive interferon expert named Sidney Grossberg, who had been quietly pursuing his own discovery of a retrovirus in an ME patient since the early 1990s at the University of Wisconsin. Indeed, in May 2013, once XMRV was laid to rest, Grossberg published his observation that the pathogen was a member of the gamma retrovirus family. Specifically, it was a murine leukemia virus, as XMRV was believed to be. It was, he continued, distinct from XMRV. Grossberg went on to suggest that in future studies, his techniques be used to expand the detection of a subset of viruses related to murine leukemia viruses. Would Mikovits have been treated as harshly had she been a man? Certainly, the discoverers of XMRV were men, and none of them suffered the malignant news coverage, internet hazing, or public drubbing she would suffer. Would journalists John Cohen and Martin Enserink of Science have tag-teamed Mikovits, as they did in the summer of 2012, to produce an 8-page classic work of character assassination in September of 2011 in Science? Enserink trailed Mikovits around Brussels and the university town of Leuven, Belgium, during a scientific conference there, and Cohen later followed her from California to Reno, apparently in large part to obtain her jail mugshot, which appeared on page one of their story. I witnessed Mikovits talk herself hoarse with Enserink over a period of days in an effort to explain her scientific methods and hypotheses. I failed to recognize a word she had said to him in the article that resulted. Or was it the fact that the public health establishment largely perceives ME as a disease of women, resulting in derision and dismissal not just of patients, but of the scientists who seek to identify the etiology of their disease, especially if they too are women? As recently as December 2013, one newly retired NIH scientist was asked by a patient at a medical conference in New York City what the NIH leadership really thought about this disease. After a pause in which he seemed to be weighing his words, the scientist replied, unsmilingly, "They hate you." Can the rocky history of an epidemic that so far has impacted two human generations be attributed to misogyny, in the way foot-dragging on AIDS during the early 1980s is attributed to homophobia? Or does the explanation lie with the CDC and NIH imperative to save face, with the need to avoid any admission that taxpayer-supported health agencies have failed so profoundly and for so long? Or is it to do with the avoidance of the class-action lawsuits Mikovits predicted? We are not primed as a society to ponder whether these agencies are conspiring, by default or purposefully, to keep the population ignorant of real and present threats to our lives and the lives of our children. The history of this disease, however, and the often devastating experiences of scientists who have tried to crack the case, force any thinking person to consider that possibility. What cannot be disputed, Judy Mikovits changed a stale quarter-century debate about the legitimacy of ME to a conversation about its biological cause, its modes of transmission, and rational drug therapies. She reopened the Pandora's box that was slammed shut when the CDC attempted to bury Elaine DeFreitas. She made the disease real for a while, a momentous feat in itself, and moved the focus of the scientific community away from its symptoms toward its cause. She broke the spell of nihilism. She also proposed a reasonable hypothesis about a possible infectious agent driving the autism epidemic. In a rational world, her hypothesis would be pursued aggressively. More broadly, Mikovits brought a once quiet, even esoteric conversation among molecular and evolutionary biologists out of the closet and into the mainstream. Is it possible that one virus or a closely related family of viruses might be causing the neurological diseases such as ME, autism, even possibly ALS and Parkinson's disease, as well as the epidemics of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and leukemia? One hopes for greater honesty and a new spirit of open-mindedness from government officials in the future. When so many are sick and the cost to the culture is so high, every discovery should be examined and explored without bias and with great urgency. Honest scientists need to know they will be supported in their endeavors to solve difficult problems rather than burned at the stake. One hopes, too, for the salvation of the millions of people who have been disappeared by their governments for having acquired a disease that cannot be acknowledged by those governments, and those who will become ill in the years ahead if there is a return to the status quo that Judy Mikovits disrupted for 3 brilliant years.